So today I'm going to talk a little bit about some research work that we did while we were still a part of Alphabet. So I'm now working for a company called Zanbox AQ, which is a former, was a spin-off from Alphabet. It was a project that has been located at X, which is the moonshot, formerly known as the Moonshot Factory. It's the place where people, they come up with crazy ideas and then try to, push them forward. So Zanbox has been there at X. We were working on a lot of different crazy things. And one of those is what I want to present today, which is how to run tensor network calculations on tensor processing units, specifically the density matrix and normalization group. So this work is has been done with a large number of people. So some of them, are actually also former Perimeter alumni. So Marcus Hauru was a PhD student here. Adam Lewis was a postdoc here. And Ijian was a, Ijian Zhu was also a PhD student, and Giffrey was a faculty here. So it's like a, it's a Perimeter collaboration. Just not done at Perimeter. So let's start with this talk. So,
Mike, I don't hear.
Is it? I think it's on.
Okay, maybe it's just recording.
Hello, hello.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, very good. So I want to talk about today about tensor network simulations and how to speed them up. But before that, I want to take a little bit of a step back and give some sort of a motivating introduction. And that is, to settle sort of the space that we're going to talk about today, and that is quantum simulations. So the work, that we did here and that we're still doing is in this space of simulating quantum systems on classical computers. I think I don't have to motivate many people here, because it's like people do in this audience, I think, do this all the time. But as I think as everyone knows, one big interest that people have here in this field is trying to understand strongly correlated materials or strongly correlated molecules. Strongly correlated here means that you have to treat essentially the system as a many-body system and then try to, understand it, solve this in some either numerical fashion or with some sort of advanced analytical tools. So we're mostly interested in numerics here. And these problems are infamously challenging. So it's like this problem of, these many-body problems scale very poorly with the size of the system. So it's very hard to solve these types of problems. And there is a large number, over decades and decades of research, people have come up with all these different types of methods to sort of tackle these problems. I'm just listing a few here, density functional theories has been one of the most important, I think, numerical tools for many, many decades. And Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo, is sort of the hammer in the toolbox. You just apply it to everything that doesn't have the sign problem, and sometimes even apply it to that.
So. Also, human brain. Human brain there.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's true. Yes. The human brain is sort of behind all of this in some sense, right? And then more recently, I think, tensor networks have come along starting in the 90s and have nowadays become one of the, standard tools in this toolbox. And more recently, neural networks have also been used. And this is Roger has sort of spearheaded that development. And then there's a lot more, of course. I don't even know all of them, but I don't, just want to make sure that you don't get the idea that that's all of it. So what I want to talk about here in particular is two things. I mostly will spend time on tensor networks, but I just want to also spend a few words on neural networks now, because they're actually very similar in some sense, right? There seem to be some similarities between those two. The main point is that of this talk is how can these types of quantum simulations that we're trying to run here benefit from hardware accelerators. So hardware accelerators. Well, I think we all have seen what's happening in this AI world. This AI revolution that we're all experiencing right now is you know, some people argue has been like only possible with like the access, you know, the access to large amounts of data and like large amounts of compute. So that has been some sort of the driving force. And now it's sort of in lockstep, right? There is new networks come out, and there's like research going on in developing new sort of architectures. And then at the same time, hardware vendors try to push their hardware to even larger sizes and make them even faster so that people can train larger models. And it's sort of an arms race what's going on here. But I think what's pretty common, or you know, what's, I think that the general opinion is that the success of neural network depends pretty critically on the access to these hardware accelerators, because you need to train them, and it's just very, very painfully, you know, like computationally intensive task to do that. And I think, you know, the big success of neural networks has also come along because these hardware accelerators have spread so much and have developed this so much. So what about tensor networks? So tensor networks are also a tool for simulating strongly correlated quantum systems. And they have been investigated for a number of years now, and people use them actually, you know, in all types of applications. They have a property that, you know, I'll mention later a little bit more, where they scale polynomially in the system size, which makes them, you know, an attractive tool to solve many body systems. But they can become computationally demanding as well, even though they're polynomially scaling. So one thing that, you know, I want to talk about today is like how these types of applications can benefit from hardware accelerators. And this is a field that has already, like, people have been working on that. Most importantly, I think one person that has been in this field for very long is Ersch Legessa. He's like one of the very early adopters of tensor network methods to solve quantum chemistry problems, and has pushed that field really far. And he's, for example, also like developing tools to, or applying, he's using GPUs to accelerate these types of simulations. And so it's been around in the community, but I think there could be more focus on how to use GPUs to accelerate tensor networks, because, you know, as we'll see, I think you can benefit a lot from these types of from this novel type of hardware.
Just to point out, Katie Hai was also a student.
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah. Katie. Yeah. Exactly. So Katie has also some. I'm not aware of any publication that came out of this, but she was actually working on that as well. She was also one of the early applications, or, you know, of how to run, one of the early usages of GPUs to speed up tensor network calculations were also done by her. So the most famous tensor network that is around is, of course, the density matrix normalization group. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. This is just a quick summary. So this is an algorithm for originally approximating ground states of one-dimensional local Hamiltonians as matrix product states. And it's, you know, has like actually by now been applied to a large number of problems outside of this domain. So people have used this to, you know, it's been used for material science. It's been applied to quantum chemistry. It's more recently to even machine learning, and you can even do like solve partial differential equations with it. Like people are exploring nowadays the use for numerical mathematics, like high dimensional integration and so on and so forth. So it's a very versatile tool. But still, the basics of this density matrix normalization group algorithms, or the basic building blocks that you need to run this, are they show up in all types of other applications as well. So this is why in the following work we're going to focus on this specific algorithm, which is like one example of a tensor network algorithm, but it's one of the most important ones, and it can serve as a stepping stone towards all other applications. So in the following talk, the thing I want to talk about is how to speed up this algorithm, so this density matrix normalization group. And I'm going to like talk about three things. So I'll start off with giving you a brief overview of TPUs. What are TPUs? This is the hardware accelerator that we've been using to speed up this algorithm. I'll talk briefly about tensor networks, and I'll show you some results at the end of the talk. Okay, so tensor processing units. So what are tensor processing units? So this tensor processing units are a special type of hardware similar to GPUs. just a little bit larger, that Google has built to support their large-scale machine learning workflows. So they have, for example, used this to train AlphaFold. So these GPUs are just giant computers that have, you know, it's a connection of hardware accelerators like GPUs that are sort of linked together in some special sort of way. And Google is hosting them mostly internally in their data centers for a long time. They have been only accessible internally, but then at some point they have decided to make this also accessible from the outside. So you can rent these machines, you can run stuff on it, and mainly they're just very good at matrix multiplication. So this is just like a hardware built to do matrix multiplications. So when I was at this time, you know, we started this work when I was transitioning to work for Alphabet. And one thing that we were asking ourselves when we came there, or you know, how this whole collaboration actually started, was the question, can we use tensor processing units to do tensor networks? Because there was like the word tensor showing up in both. So that was sort of the basic starting point. And now I just want to give you some sort of a brief like overview of how does the hardware look like. So a tensor processing chip or a TPU, these usually come in like the largest thing that comes along is a pod, and this pod is a concatenation or a combination of smaller units. And the smallest unit that shows up there is the so-called TPU board. So TPU board, that's this thing here, colored within Google's colors, of course, consists of four identical units here. So there is one here, one here, one here, and one here. So they're like stitched together on one board. And this thing here, this is a floor plan of how this hardware looks like. So this is a chip that does something for you. It's like the computation, like the CPU chip in your computers, just a little bit different. So this is the thing that does all the calculations. It has like two so-called, so these blue boxes here, those two here, they do all the operations. This is the stuff that does the calculation for you. It has certain thing called matrix multiply units, two of them. So this is actually the TPU version 3 I'm talking about here. This is like an older version. There's a later version out here, and I don't know how that looks. But at least this version here is so-called matrix multiply units. So what this thing is doing is reading in data from a register and then, assuming it's a matrix, and multiplies it and then stores the result in another register. And there's a bunch of other things there, like one hardware component can do transpositions, one hardware component can do application of functions through elements. And each of them has two, like each of these guys has two of these units. And then there is so-called high bandwidth memory, which is a very special type of memory, which is extremely fast to read and write, read from and write to. So each of these guys can like store data in the 16 gigabyte memory slots here. And then there is another component here, which is called an intercore interconnect. That is a hardware that allows these like cores to communicate with each other very fast. And the point is that like all this hardware has just been like custom built to be extremely good at what it's supposed to do. So these guys here, the communication here is very, very fast. Like it's comparable actually when this was, I think, first built, it was the fastest communication that was out there. Or at least, so it's comparable to what NVIDIA, for example, has. They call this NVLink. It's also a very fast communication channel for between cores. So this is like on a similar speed. So one of these guys has around 120 teraflops peak performance. So one of these things here in BFloat 16 is like a special data type that you run your machine learning workloads on. If you want to do Float 32, it becomes less. It's only 4. So you can usually, all these machines come natively. They do floating point 16 operations. So BFloat is some sort of special custom data type, and you can get higher precision out of it by doing multiple rounds of BFloat 16 operations. So this is the cost. Of course, if you do that, there is a cost, which is you have to do multiple, so the total performance slows down. So roughly, one of these guys is comparable to a GPU. So why why are we even caring about this if there's GPUs out there and we could use GPUs as well? So the main benefit of these TPUs, at least at the point where we did this work, was that you can couple all of these single chips that I just wrote you, showed you there. You can couple them into a compute cluster. This is the TPU pod. It's a tightly coupled cluster of these computation, of these units.
Are these TPUs available commercially?
Yes, and they are available for rent. You cannot buy it. It would be very expensive, but you can rent it. So Google will, so you have to like apply it. So there's some sort of process. It's not too complicated, but if you have the money, you can.
It reminded me of Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, this thing there, yes. It is. I don't actually know how large that is, but it's you know, probably comparable. But the whole rack, you know, would fill like a big room. So you would need quite a storage facility to be able to host that. Yes?
Another question. Are they more energy efficient?
Yes. Yeah. So one of the main reasons like Google was actually looking into this is because they realized that running this with, in 2010 or 2011, there was a study where they were trying to understand how much energy do we need? How do our workloads scale into the future? And then they realized, oh, we have to do something because it's going to be like too expensive. There is like too much energy consumed. So this was one of the main motivations to build these machines is they use less energy. So they are actually not very, so they're pretty cheap on that point. I don't know the numbers actually. I knew them once, but I forgot. And they come up nowadays in sizes up to 4,096 of these. There's 4,096 compute cores, which is pretty big, and you can just rent them on Google Cloud. So one out, like renting a pod costs roughly one. So I think the price was $8 per chip or something like that per hour. So if you had a chip with eight cores, you know, it was $8 per hour, probably the V4 is a little bit more expensive. I don't know what's the pricing today, but you can think of roughly like renting a pod for 1 hour is around $2,000. So this is how this thing looks like. So this is what you can, you know, pictorially think of it being built up. So the whole pod of, you know, these like chips that I was showing you, there is 16 by 16. Each of the chip has like four of these units in it, right? So if you sum everything up, you'll end up with around 2,048 TPU cores. So these were these blue boxes that I was showing, the boxes with the blue stuff in it. It has about 32 terabyte of memory, which is non-shared. Like, you know, each of these guys inside there has like 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, 16, and so on and so forth. It's all non-shared. So it's not like one giant block of memory, but they're all connected to nearest neighbors. It's a torus, actually. So you can communicate data from here to here by going, you know, bloop, 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 through all these links, but they're pretty fast. So you can actually do it quite efficiently. So it's much faster, for example, than InfiniBand, which is what people usually use in academic clusters. So here is the rate of data transfer is around more than 650 gigabits per second. Here's just another view of it. It's essentially the same thing.
So B-floats reduced precision. So you run these on a reduced floating point?
Yeah, so B-float is like, they come, so it's like this specific data. It's not, it's a reduced precision where Mantissa and Exponent have some sort of a, it's not the usual way it's split up. I forgot exactly how many bits are for which part, but it's a little bit different than the regular floating point 16. But so this is how this usually works. But then, so the operations are all done in bfloat. But then the accumulation, there's an accumulation step happening that is done in float 32. And so because of that, you can actually emulate float 32 by doing multiple passes of bfloat 16s. And then it just becomes a little bit more expensive to do it. So if you do float 32, you'll have less performance, essentially. So what are some challenges that we were facing? So one of the biggest challenges we were at, in our case, was linear algebra, because we had to do linear algebra, and there's just no packages out there which just run out of the box for you. So we had to do that ourselves. So we had to find ways of doing QR decompositions, other types of decompositions, all the things you need to run tensor network algorithms. So that's kind of a little bit tricky. And so that's the first thing, you have to do it yourself. Then the second thing is where you go to your favorite, you go to LAPACK, and then you're like, how the hell did they do that? And then you look at it, and then you realize, oops, it can't really do it like that, because a TPU is not a universal computer like your CPU is. So it's good at certain things, but it's really bad at others. So you have to find other ways of doing that. So this is another challenge you'll have to tackle, which is you have to sort of come up with different algorithms. Fortunately, there is already a research community out there that has spent quite some time on that. So we were actually able to gain a lot, get a lot of input from this work. So then another one is that double precision comes only at a very significant computational cost. So I was telling you about single precision, float 32, that's still okay, but if you want to do double precision, at least at this point, at the point where we did this work, double precision came at a pretty severe cost. So so that made it less interesting at this point. And double precision doesn't matter so much for DMRG. It was actually, we were learning floating point 32, and that was fine. But for other applications, like density functional theory calculations, for example, it's more important to have double precision. There are still ways to fix that, but it's something you need to keep in mind. The last part is just a very technicality that I don't want to talk about.
What about the onboard memory there? 16 gigs doesn't seem like all that much.
Well, yeah. So you have in total, you have 32 terabyte. So it depends a little bit on what you want to do. I think in our case, what we had to do is essentially use secondary storage. So we were not able to store everything in the memory. So we were storing everything on disk and doing. So in the case where we have the model parallelism, you need to. In our case, we had to store everything on disk, the majority of the stuff, and then we did some optimization and we loaded into our memory, which was 32 terabytes distributed, and then you do the computations. It's fine in most cases, but it would be better to have more. memory is, in particular for tensor networks, also always the bottleneck. So we were using JAX to code this. JAX offers a high-level Python interface that allows you to do these types of calculations. Okay, so we're probably going to skip this, but I'm happy to chat about that. After some pitfalls and things you have to worry about when you do these types of calculations. All right, so now let's look a little bit into just tensor networks. Got very short overview. We were running DMRG. DMRG is an algorithm to simulate, to optimize a matrix product state to approximate some ground state of a Hamiltonian. So the idea here is the following. You write your ground state as some sort of wave function in some basis. But because that is computationally inefficient, you break it down into some other object, which is an MPS here. So that's the thing that you're seeing here. Each of these guys is a tensor where each leg corresponds to a tensor index. So the horizontal ones are called ancillary indices, and vertical ones are physical indices. If you're talking about spin 1/2 systems, which is what we talk about here at all, then this has a dimension of 2. And this up here, this has a dimension capital D, which is a hyperparameter of your system. So typically, if you make D very large, then that state has more power to approximate a ground state. So you can connect these into diagrams, and these diagrams have the meaning of a computation. So I was showing you a rank 3 tensor. You can also write a matrix or a vector or a scalar. In that way, you can contract them. Contraction, so you can graphically contract them, and graphically the contraction is just performed by joining two dots or two objects to the line. So this is a matrix multiplication. This is a more complex tensor network contraction. And this is sort of the basic operation that you'll have to do all over again, over and over again in any type of tensor network calculation. The main benefit of MPS in this case is that they're efficient, in the sense that if you go from n to n plus 1 spins on the left-hand side, you double the number of coefficients you need to store. if you go to n plus n1 on the right hand side, you add a constant number of coefficients to your state. So this thing here, the size, the memory you need to reserve to store this, grows linearly with the number of spins, for example, whereas this grows exponentially. So it's quite a difference. So they are efficient to store, and they're also efficient to contract, MPS in this case R. So you can efficiently compute things from the state. A very simple example is just the wave function coefficient for some basis state is computed by simply fixing the indices here to the corresponding basis. And then you just have a sequence so that each of these guys now becomes a matrix because you fixed one index. Now this is a series of matrix multiplications. We know that this can be done efficiently. You take the trace at the end of the day, so that's this line, and you get the number out of it. So it can be done in polynomial time. Very good. And last but not least, there is this hyperparameter D that I was telling you before. It allows you to sort of make the accuracy of your state, you know, increase the accuracy of your state. You start with an MPS, you know, this is your full Hilbert space, an MPS with a fixed bond dimension, for example, D equals 1 will cover a very small corner of that Hilbert space. And of course, the Hilbert space is not really convex here, but you know, just think of it this way. You can make the dimension larger and larger and larger, and you will see pictorially that the size of Hilbert space you can cover will also become a little bit larger. If you want to recover the full Hilbert space, you'll need an exponential bond dimension again. So everything is consistent. And people have explored many other types of networks. I'm not going to mention any of those, just like flashing a picture here so that you have seen that. So here is the basic of the algorithm that we are running. It's called DMRG. So DMRG is the is trying to optimize an MPS over it's trying to approximate the ground state of a Hamiltonian in variationally. So it's writing the energy. What you do is you write the energy expectation value of your Hamiltonian over given some MPS, and you try to optimize this. The Hamiltonian here is this thing. You can, you know, it just comes along. So someone gave it to you. It can be written as a tensor network. So what DMRG does is optimize site after site after site, move along from left to right and from right to left, and optimizes always one of these tensors at a time while keeping all others fixed, and in that way trying to, you know, make the energy smaller and smaller. So people have applied that to 2D systems. So this works great in 1D. And it's becoming the gold standard. People have also looked at applications beyond one-dimensional systems because that's where actually things have become much more interesting. What you were seeing here is some sort of a 1D geometry, right? It's like a chain, so it has a one dimension, but you can map this. You can map this onto a two-dimensional grid if you want to. And can apply the same procedure of optimization given some sort of two-dimensional Hamiltonian. What you do is you snake through the system in this way and just, you know, do the same. Technically, you can do the same thing and you would be very happy and say, well, great, that was fantastic. The problem is that if you do that, there is a penalty. Essentially, what it means, so this, you know, after some, you can make some arguments that that the bond dimension of this, if you put an MPS here onto this two-dimensional system, you will see that the bond dimension has to grow exponentially with the width of the cylinder. So this is a very challenging problem for DMRG. But we would like actually to apply, to use like these large-scale accelerators to speed up the DMRG calculations or push them to very large bond dimensions such that we can treat such problems. So this is really the thing that we were trying to do. So we wanted to look, can DMRG be, you know, can we, so this it was sort of the test bet that of problems that we were looking at. We were trying to understand how to scale that algorithm up to extremely large bond dimensions to treat such two-dimensional quantum systems, where we know in principle that it's always inefficient to do it, but you know, you can sort of try to do that and see what you can get out of this. Okay, so I'm rushing a little bit here because I don't know how long is it, like 45 minutes or an hour? doesn't matter. Okay.
All right. It won't cut you off once you go like an hour and 15
minutes. Okay, yeah. So I should be fine. Like, I'll finish in like 15 more minutes. Okay, so the goal for us was to find like very hard, like, first of all, run the MRG on like large clusters, and then find a problem that is like challenging for it so that we can evaluate the benefit. The problem is like two-dimensional systems or quantum systems in 2D. So now let's look a little bit in more detail on how, you know, which part of this algorithm that I was sketching before, where you go and optimize one side after the other, which of these, which parts of the algorithm are actually the important ones and that need to be sped up. And there is mainly three. So those are the three that you can see here. The first one is called, so each of them plays a different type of role in this algorithm, but you need them to be able to get an efficient method. One is called orthogonalization. So what you do there is you take a tensor, you break it up into a product of two other tensors. This is usually done via so-called singular value decomposition or QR decomposition, you know, matrix decompositions. You know, these triangles here are unitaries. This like circle here can be something, just a matrix. So that is one of the operations that needs to be done. And we have to think about how to scale that up. The other one is rank reduction. So typically in these algorithms, you at some point you face the situation that you have a large tensor that has some, you know, very large bond dimension here in the tens of thousands. And you need to break it up into something that is, you know, two objects that are smaller. So that's a typical situation that you'll face a lot of times. And there are ways of doing that. Typically, the way that people do it is, again, singular value decomposition. So you do an SVD of a matrix where you consider those two legs and those two legs as the rows and columns of a matrix, and you do an SVD of it. So that's another operation you have to worry about. And the third one are network contractions. So that's already what we've seen before. The one typical operation that you need to do, for example, for DMRG is contract such a network. You have like a number of tensors that have, again, very large legs here, high dimensional legs, tens of thousands here, and tens of thousands here, and maybe a few hundred here, and, you know, maybe a few dozen, up to a few dozen here. And you need to contract this thing, and you need to, you know, also speed that up. So these are the three things you really want to like get a handle on to be able to like scale the algorithm, to scale the method to large sizes. And typically, so this is in essence what you do here in practice is you reduce everything to matrix multiplications. So you have a sequence of matrix multiplications that you're performing. And on your CPU, you can use GEM or DGEM or CGEM. Anything that BLAS has to give you or has to offer you, you'll just use that. So the point is that these types of things, these operations, they turn up not just here in this algorithm, but in a bunch of other algorithms as well. So if you're able to scale that one up and make it very efficient, to run it efficiently in large scale accelerators, you can do another set of tasks as well. You know, some of them, there are things like time-dependent DMRG. You can do time evolution with TDVP. You can do PEPs. You can do MERA. So there's a number of things that you know, pop out of this once you have sort of solved that type of problem. Okay, so now let's see how we do that. Where is this coming from? So the point is, none of these operations are actually available on these machines, right? It's because they don't have it. So it's not like, so these machines have been designed to do machine learning, and machine learning is, there is like rarely you'll have to do a matrix decomposition, right? Or an SVD maybe, but usually no. Usually you just do non-linearities, matrix multiplications, and then you minimize with a stochastic gradient descent. So it's not so complicated, right? I mean, there's lots of stuff involved, but the technicality is it's less linear algebra in a sense than what we actually need to do.
So is the reason they're reduced precision, like the hardware, is because why? Is because you don't need your weights, your biases, yeah, at that high of precision?
I think there's just no real benefit in going with like floats 64 or something like that for these types of applications, because you have a cross entropy and then you like minimize some sort of, I don't know, there's some cost function that you minimize, but I don't think that, you know, it doesn't matter so much, first of all, do you find the like absolute minimum, or where are you in this landscape? So it might matter for things like stability of optimization maybe, but then I think they just brute force it, to be honest, and just go ahead and just and it reduces the cost, the memory footprint considerably if you go to lower like precision, and it's also much faster. So I don't know. So I'm not an expert, but on the ML side, but it's not really a thing. So people actually go to float 8 right now, or even worse, right?
Yeah. And yeah, my other question. So the basically what you just showed is like how you optimize the tensor network. Let me put it that way. It's fully deterministic, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We're often do machine learning on, even if you have a wave function onsets and a neural network, it's stochastic gradient descent. That's basically all.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So as far as I understand, in 1D, this your deterministic optimization always beats any sort of SGD.
So in 1D, I would say so. But I mean, it depends. So 1D local Hamiltonian, it's very hard to beat the emerging 1D to be to like this. That's, I think, the essence.
Yeah, I think maybe that's my question. Why? Yeah.
Why it is that?
Why
in,
is it hard to beat the emerging in one dimension? I've never seen any either, obviously. So.
Yeah, it's. I mean,
because of the deterministic optimization of the parameters.
I mean, I think that plays. So I think there's like multiple things. I don't have like a really good answer to that, but. So in my opinion, I think it is a combination of things. It's the fact that we know, for example, we have all these tricks that we're applying. We use like gauging techniques to make like there's like an optimization involved, like a diagonalization. So what you can do is you can bring this into a form where everything becomes orthogonal. You have certainly an orthogonal basis, and then the optimization problem is very well conditioned. So, and you know, there is like these tricks that people apply, and then you know how to optimally truncate, and you move around these centrosites, and it's all these things I think that play an important role, because if you don't do that, you know, then sometimes if you just go and do like a very simple gradient optimization without thinking too much about how to do it, then it doesn't perform so well. It's important that all the steps are just very accurately done, and you know, it's like there's like all these tricks. I think it's similar to the So a similar thing is, I think, happening with neural networks, where, you know, it's like a combination of a lot of like expertise in like small things that have been done very well to like make them so efficient. You use like very good tokenizers, for example, to build, you know, to tokenize your language, for example. And then you have, you know, all these like tricks where do you skip, and, you know, what is connected with what. And so I think it's a similar thing in 1D, and so for the MRG, it's just everything is just fits so well that it's very hard to do better than that. And maybe the landscape is also because of that, because the landscape of optimization may just look very nice because of all these tricks. Okay. So yeah, so here's just a quick overview of. So how did we tackle this problem in general? The first one is, I want to like just highlight is tensor contractions. How do we do the tensor contractions? In essence, for DMRG, you can think of the tensor as a sequence of matrices. The rank 3 tensor, so you think of it as a sequence of rank 2 tensors, matrices. And now each of these matrices is like living on the whole cluster, right? So you have one matrix and a number of processors. If you, for example, have like 8 of these cores, then each core owns a certain small piece of the matrix, right? P1, 2, 3. Each core has like, core 1, for example, has this piece of all the matrices, core 2 has this piece of all the matrices, and so on. So they're all like somewhere living completely distributed. And they don't really know anything of each other. You reduce tensor contractions essentially to loops over this index, and tensor multiplications or matrix multiplications along, you know, the dimensions of these guys. And these tensor contractions or matrix multiplications, in our case, we did with SUMA. SUMA is just an algorithm to do distributed matrix multiplication. So that turned out to be relatively easy to do. The other one I want to quickly walk you through is orthogonalization. that is a little bit more tricky. So you need to, you have a tensor, what you want to do, you break it into like a unitary or an isometry and some other tensor. You can really do QR decomposition here because that didn't exist at that point. It does actually exist now, but when we were doing that work, it didn't. So what we did instead is use another type of decomposition called a polar decomposition. So this is where all these like work from like other research like areas comes in. People have explored how to use, for example, polar decompositions to build all types of other decompositions out of it. It's actually a very beautiful field. So you can, polar decomposition is a very simple thing where you just take a matrix and you decompose it into a unitary and a positive semi-definite matrix. The decomposition always exists, so you can do it. And there is a very simple matrix valued iteration that you can do to arrive at it. It's called the Newton-Schultz iteration. So X is a matrix here. You start with some initial guess x0, and then you just iterate this to infinity. And you will end up, voila, with the unitary factor. It's an easy, you can show that, actually. It's very, very straightforward to show. But it turns out that it, while this is not super efficient on a computer, on a CPU, because you do more than actually you would require, there are other ways of doing that which are faster. On GPUs and accelerators, it's actually good because this does only do matrix multiplications and subtractions, so there is nothing fancy going on in that sense. So you can scale that up very easily. Once you can do matrix multiplications, you already can do like the polar decomposition. So that is sort of the basic thing, that the basic ingredient that, you know, we use all over the place to do all our matrix factorizations. And that converges very quickly. So you can show like some, this is a very simple version of it. There's some more improved versions that converge within maybe 20 or 30 steps. And then you can also do rank reduction. It's like a similar thing. I'm not going to talk about that. I just want to tell you that this decomposition, this polar decomposition, can be used as one part of a larger algorithm to do rank reduction. You never need to do an SVD to do a rank reduction. You can do it entirely without SVD. And if you're interested, here's the description of how to do it. It's also in this paper that you know we published. It's in the appendix. But it's a beautiful application actually of the polar decomposition. So because of that, so the problem with the SVD again is that all these CUDA and other, you know, hardware vendor, like NVIDIA, the hardware vendor, they have like CUDA, which is a library to dispatch kernels onto their hardware for certain types of computations. They give you an SVD, but it's actually not very fast. So it, like, the problem is you can make it faster than on your CPU, but it doesn't show you like a 100-fold speed up or a 200-fold speed up. It may be like be 5 times faster, 10 times faster, something like that. So it's much slower. The speed up is much less than just a plain matrix multiplication. And the reason is like because of all these like the standard way of doing SVD is just the way you do it in LAPACK. It doesn't parallelize very well. It's quite a tricky problem. So if you want to run SVD simulations based, then you don't need a lot of SVDs. You're running into trouble if you do it the same, you know, the standard way. So you have to do something else. And I just want to tell you that that's possible. Okay, so last few minutes, I'm just going to show you some sort of benchmark results now on how large can we go and how accurate can we get. And we used like two Hamiltonians that we looked at, were the free Fermion Hamiltonian and the transfer sealedizing model, of course, because you have to do the transfer sealedizing model. So why did we choose these types of Hamiltonians? So these are both in 2D. So we put, in this case, for the free fermions, we have a 10 by 10 lattice of fermions that can hop. So this is a very trivial problem from almost all points of view, except the MRG, because if you look at this model, you will see that it has the ground state has a Fermi surface. And because of that Fermi surface, you can show that the ground state has a logarithmic correction to an area law. So there is an area law, but there is a logarithmic correction to it. It's like something like L log L in 2D. So that's a quite challenging thing for DMRG. It's already, you know, GMRG we know can capture area laws in 1D. You cannot do anything in 2D. So even if you have a 2D gap system with an exact area law that's challenging. If you now have a 2D system that is gapless and has a logarithmic correction on top of its area law, then that's really challenging for DMRG. So this is why we looked at it. So if you look at the entanglement spectrum, so you can, for a 10 by 10 lattice, you can plot the entanglement spectrum. Looks something like this. So I is just the of this cut. So you look at a cut along here of the ground state, you'll see this type of spectrum. Now you can sort of measure or estimate what bond dimension do I need from this spectrum to get such and such an accuracy for my simulation. So this is an upper bound, right? So, and you'll see if you want to get an upper bound of, I don't know, 10 to the 4, something like this, you need like a million or something like this, a really large bond dimension. So it is quite challenging.
What's the total number of parameters in the tensor network then?
So I'll show you, like the largest one we were running had like 600 billion. But probably it was, I mean, you can do less. It's not necessary to do so many, but we just wanted to show off essentially, right? So, so this is now the simulation results for finding the ground state of that model with DMRG. What you see here is the bond dimension. So we go from, you know, something like 4,096, this powers of 2, up to 65,536, 2 to the 16. And this is like the ground state energy. You see it converges. So the red line is the one that you would expect from an analytic solution. So, you know, you see a very nice convergence. And this is like a behavior of the relative error as a function of bond dimensions. It's the same thing, essentially. So you just see a convergence. And we can get to an error of around 10 to the minus 6 at a bond dimension of 65,000. So that is, you know, it's very hard to you just have to throw everything at it to get it. It's like the simulation costs probably, I don't know, $20,000. And I don't know why. It's like the ground, we found the ground set of the free fermion model for that. But, well, we've shown that you can actually scale that up very nicely. And one important point is that we haven't utilized any symmetries here, right? So this is like a dense calculation. So this model has a symmetry. It has a U1 symmetry. Depending on the parameters, I think it may even have a C2 symmetry. So then you can, you could use that to reduce the number of parameters substantially and also make it faster. So it will reduce the memory. It'll increase the speed. But we didn't use that here, right? So this is really not. It's like a very, very simple applicate. So very simple algorithm that uses only dense matrices. So another thing we looked at is the transfer serializing model. And it's a similar plot, just that we don't really know the energy here, the exact one. So we, you know, this has a phase transition at a value of around 3 of magnetic field. So we tuned it roughly there. And at that point, it just becomes robustly entangled. It's a very entangled state. In this case, we went to 20 by 20. You know, we can again show like for 32,000, I think we went to 46,000 in this case, but you're already like hitting numerical precision at this point. So it doesn't really pay off to do anything else, anything larger. So we stopped there. And this is a plot that shows you the string and the weak scaling. So the strong and the weak scaling of a how it scales, you know, how the method scales with the, as you increase the size of the problem and so this is the wall time essentially as you make for a fixed problem size as a function of the number of devices, as the size of the cluster that you're using. So for 16,000, a bond dimension of 16,000, we see, you know, we double the number of devices. So we have like only 3 points here. What you'll see is that the time reduces by a little bit less than a factor of 2. So it's a factor. So this should go down by, so it should be something like 1 over D. But it's a little bit less. So it's not the ideal scaling you would get if this was 1. So it's a little bit less than 1. But it's still very good, in my opinion. And so this is a plot for weak scaling. No, sorry, this is, I think this is strong scaling. And then this weak scaling is when you also increase the problem size as you increase the number of cores or increase the available compute. So what we do here, we show runtimes for different bond dimensions of problems. But then we also increase the number of compute cores that we have. So here we run one dimension of 2 to the 14 on a 32 machine, on a core, on a machine with 32 class, with 32 cores. Then 2 to the 15 on a machine with 128 cores, and then 2 to the 16 on one with 512 cores. And what we'll see is essentially an almost perfect scaling. So D equal to 1 would be the optimal one. So you can theoretically show that as you double the bond dimension, the algorithm scales as a third power of the bond dimension, so it should like give you a factor of 8. But because you doubled also the number of compute, that this will give you another factor of reduction. So, you know, there's an ideal law that you should get out of it, and we're getting relatively close to that. So if you run DMRG with 2 to the 16, that's like around 65,000, then one step of optimization will take, depending on the parameters, of course, because you can't really give a plain number for that. But for the parameters we chose that turn out to work well, it's around 2 minutes per optimization step. So the whole simulation will take about 20 hours, depending on how often you have to sweep back and forth and, you know, some other, it will also vary from problem to problem, but it's within less than a day on half a core. So we could even like go to a larger cluster here, and then it would be a little bit faster.
And that's all 20 by 20 open boundary?
This is like 10 by 10, I think, open boundary for the free fermion model. Yeah, and that's the summary. So I think that we've seen, so in our work, that these tensor network algorithms, they just scale very well to hardware accelerators. I think there are like one ideally suited probably to like benefit from this. And you can get, so we ran, you know, here you see, we ran DMRG with like 65,000. That's around 600 billion parameter optimization, right? Nice. It's in less than a one day. It was very well behaved. So optimizing 600 billion parameters, this is not, so it depends on who you ask, but some people will be very impressed and say, wow, 600 billion parameters. But DMRG, again, is like also a very nice method in that sense, because, you know, the landscape, it's just like so well developed that, you know, this optimization just works so well there that, I think it's still great. I mean, it's still interesting to see that it's possible. I think the main thing is that it's just possible to scale that up, and you get very good utilization of your hardware with these methods. You can go to symmetries. You can also implement symmetries. It will make things more complicated, but this will yield additional benefits. So there's a very recent paper by Menzer and Legesa. They published just like a few days ago a paper where they were using large-scale GPU hardware to run quantum chemistry-type calculations, where they have like U1 symmetry, for example, implemented. And they're going to like SU2 symmetry very soon. So you can implement symmetries as well. It will reduce the memory footprint, but you will still benefit quite a bit from using these hardware accelerators. So I think it's a very promising thing to do. Probably, I think that in the future, you know, this is really, I think, something that, you know, people will do more and more, because the benefits are just very big, in my opinion. And you can also, you know, this has been, people so far have mostly, I mean, people are looking into PEPs, and we have also looked into Mera a little bit on how, and with Mera you see like humongous speedups if you run it on GPU, you know, like the factors in the hundreds. I'm not aware of any PEPs calculation, but people have done it, I'm pretty sure. You can do non-equilibrium methods. Again, this is a little bit challenging, more challenging because of SVD. But now that we know how to do the SVD without, or truncate without doing the SVD, I mean, there's, you know, another large number of, you can get large speedups here. There's recent work from Frank Polman. He has actually started to look into that as well. I think the importance of these hardware accelerators for tensor networks calculations will increase just a lot in the future. And I'm very excited to see where this is going. So that's about all. Just short of 1 hour. Thanks.
Questions?
Yeah?
You mentioned you get advantages on the memory if you start to incorporate some symmetries. Do you get improvements in like the runtime as well?
So the question is, like, if you get runtime improvements from incorporating memory, symmetries, the answer is yes, you get that. So if you do it in CPU, there is I can tell you that if you go, for example, from no symmetry to U1 symmetry, then you get roughly a factor of 10, an order of magnitude, and I think probably another factor of 5 or 10 if you go to something higher, SU2, for example. The problem is doing that on GPUs is that so GPUs become, and hardware accelerators, they become like very, very good or very efficient once the problems are big, right? If you have to multiply two matrices with dimensions of 10,000 by 10,000, then you know they're very good at that. But if you have to multiply a million matrices of dimension 4 by 4, you know, then things are less obvious. You could still parallelize that in ways that are smart, but if there's more structure to the problem, if not a totally embarrassingly parallel, but it breaks down into small tasks that are sort of interdependent, then it's less clear. But still, you get large speedups. You get speedups from considering symmetries on GPUs as well. But the number right there, I don't really know. Yeah?
So if you were to compare the DMRG calculation with the 600 billion parameters with one that's not using a TPU, like, what's the difference in the time it takes and how much it would cost to actually do the computation?
Yeah, so we did like an estimate. I mean, it really depends on what type of hardware you're using, right? I think like the largest calculation that we were running would take on like some sort of shared memory machine with around 96 cores, and assuming that you would actually be able to store that somehow, I don't know, like years, many, many years. But I don't know. So I had some ridiculous, at some point, there was a ridiculous number, like 200 years or something like that. But I don't actually know in which context that number. But you know, you can also go to larger clusters. People also use large CPU clusters to do these calculations. And in that case, I don't know, this is probably still faster and also cheaper because it consumes less energy. But I don't really know how the timings would compare. So it would be an interesting thing to look at. Yeah?
Yeah, so I think the problems you showed, the three fermions and the 2D lattice model, I think like those are probably well understood, or the physics is, I think, maybe well understood.
Yeah.
But like, do you think that this like massive DMRG calculations, like, is there a problem you would like to tackle with this where you could probe new physics that people haven't looked at before?
Yeah, I mean, I think what would be interesting to do is real-time evolution with it.
Sorry?
Real-time evolution is one of the things. So I think what one should try to use PEPS one should like sort of like have PEPS simulations with these types of systems. That's one of the things, because they're going, you know, if you can double the model dimension going, I don't know, 32D equals 32 PEPS or something like that, without any symmetries, then that would be, I think, quite huge. So one thing I think I would do, I would like to do, is study, you know, apply this to some sort of PEPS algorithm or other like algorithms in higher dimensions. The other one would be time evolution, and you could combine that to time evolution with PEPS, like everything where that's just like really, really costly and, you know, has a huge bad scaling with one dimension. You know, I would definitely be worth looking at with such accelerators.
So can, by if you projected this, can you now solve the two-dimensional Hubbard model without melting and polarizing?
I don't know. Probably not. I mean,
I'll scale it.
Oh yeah, I don't want to like go down that rabbit hole. But yeah, I mean, you could at least try. You know, you can certainly like run a large scale Hubbard model calculation. I don't know what it will give you, but I mean, I think there's tons of problems you could sort of study with that. And also, there's other applications as well outside of like quantum physics, right? That would be interesting to explore. Things where, I don't know, can you use tensor networks to model probability distributions in a similar way that people have used neural networks? You could sort of train they're just very, they're like training DMRG, like an MPS, optimizing an MPS is just a little bit easier than training a neural network. And might be better behaved. So there are also, I think, tricks that can be applied. And, you know, these tricks could be useful for these types of applications as well. I think there is a, yeah, there is many things that one, what one can look at here.
So, are there attempts to build TPUs using qubits? Classical semiconductor.
Yeah, I don't think there are. I mean, but it, you could propose it too. I mean, maybe you will
get. An MPS has been built in an ion system, hasn't it?
Yes, I think people are. I think that's the thing that people do. They use they build like these like wave functions, these special type of wave functions on quantum computers. So that's true. Like they're also doing it. You know, I think there's various groups that try to do that. The idea there could be that you have like an MPS structure on a quantum computer, but then the bond dimension is not really the thing that's limiting you anymore, right? So you can have arbitrary bond dimension in some sense, but you still have some sort of knowledge of the structure of the wave function that has been, you know, it's an interesting topic to look at.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Very good.